Chapter 44. Were a hand, and with an air of wisdom and profundity, that was the very concentration and sublimation of all philosophical reflection and grave inquiry, applied himself to the consideration of the subject in its various branches. There's a friend of mine, apostrophe murmured the captain, in an absent manner, but he's at present coasting round to Whitby, that would deliver such an opinion on this subject, or any other that could be named, as would give Parliament six and beat 'em. Been knocked overboard, that man, apostrophe said the captain, twice, and none the worse for it. Was beat in his apprenticeship, for 3 weeks off and on, about the head with a ring bolt. And yet a clear-minded man don't walk. Apostrophe, despite of his respect for Captain Cuttle, Walter could not help inwardly rejoicing at the absence of this sage, and devoutly hoping that his limpid intellect might not be brought to bear on his difficulties until they were quite settled. If he was to take, and show that man the buoy at the Nore, apostrophe said Captain Cuttle in the same tone, and ask him his opinion of it, Waller, he'd give you an opinion that was no more like that buoy than your uncle's buttons are. There ain't a man that walks certainly not on two legs that can come near him. Not near him. Apostrophe, what's his name, Captain Cuttle? Apostrophe inquired Walter, determined to be interested in the captain's friend. His name's Bunsby, said the captain. But Lord, it might be anything for the matter of that, with such a mind as his. Apostrophe, the exact idea which the captain attached to this concluding piece of praise, he did not further elucidate, neither did Walter seek to draw it forth. For on his beginning to review, with the vivacity natural to himself, and to his situation, the leading points in his own affairs, he soon discovered that the captain had relapsed into his former profound state of mind, and that while he eyed him steadfastly from beneath his bushy eyebrows, he evidently neither saw nor heard him, but remained immersed in cogitation. In fact, Captain Cuttle was laboring with such great designs, that far from being aground, he soon got off into the deepest of water, and could find no bottom to his penetration. By degrees it became perfectly plain to the captain, that there was some mistake here, that it was undoubtedly much more likely to be Walter's mistake than his, that if there were really any West India scheme afoot, it was a very different one from what Walter, who was young and rash, supposed, and could only be some new device for making his fortune with unusual celerity. Or if there should be any little hitch between them, apostrophe thought the captain, meaning between Walter and Mr. Dombey, it only wants a word in season from a friend of both parties, to set it right and smooth, and make all taut again. Apostrophe Captain Cuttle's deduction from these considerations was, that as he already enjoyed the pleasure of knowing Mr. Dombey, from having spent a very agreeable half hour in his company at Brighton on the morning when they borrowed the money, and that, as a couple of men of the world, who understood each other, and were mutually disposed to make things comfortable, could easily arrange any little difficulty of this sort, and come at the real facts. The friendly thing for him to do would be, without saying anything about it to Walter at present, just to step up to Mr. Dombey's house, say to the servant, would he be so good, my lad, as report Cap'n Cuttle here? Apostrophe meet Mr. Dombey in a confidential spirit, hook him by the buttonhole, talk it over, make it all right, and come away triumphant. As these reflections presented themselves to the captain's mind, and by slow degrees assumed this shape and form, his visage cleared like a doubtful morning, when it gives place to a bright noon. His eyebrows, which had been in the highest degree portentous, smoothed their rugged bristling aspect, and became serene. His eyes, which had been nearly closed in the severity of his mental exercise, opened freely. A smile which had been at first, but three specks, one at the right-hand corner of his mouth, and one at the corner of each eye, gradually overspread his whole face, and, rippling up into his forehead, lifted the glazed hat. As if that too had been aground with Captain Cuttle, and were now, like him, happily afloat again. Finally, the captain left off biting his nails, and said, "Now, Waller, my boy, you may help me on with them slops." Apostrophe by which the captain meant his coat and waistcoat. Walter little imagined why the captain was so particular in the arrangement of his cravat, as to twist the pendant ends into a sort of pigtail, and pass them through a massive gold ring with a picture of a tomb upon it, and a neat iron railing, and a tree, in memory of some deceased friend. Nor why the captain pulled up his shirt collar to the utmost limits allowed by the Irish linen below, and by so doing decorated himself with a complete pair of blinkers. Nor why he changed his shoes, and put on an unparalleled pair of ankle jacks, which he only wore on extraordinary occasions. The captain being at length attired to his own complete satisfaction, and having glanced at himself from head to foot in a shaving glass which he removed from a nail for that purpose, took up his knotted stick, and said he was ready. The captain's walk was more complacent than usual when they got out into the street. But this Walter supposed to be the effect of the ankle jacks, and took little heed of. Before they had gone very far, they encountered a woman selling flowers, when the captain, stopping short, as if struck by a happy idea, made a purchase of the largest bundle in her basket. A most glorious nosegay, fan-shaped, some 2 feet and a half round, and composed of all the jolliest-looking flowers that blow. Armed with this little token which he designed for Mr. Dombey, Captain Cuttle walked on with Walter until they reached the instrument maker's door, before which they both paused. "You're going in?" Apostrophe apostrophe said Walter. "Yes, apostrophe," returned the captain, who felt that Walter must be got rid of before he proceeded any further, and that he had better time his projected visit somewhat later in the day. "And you won't forget anything?" Apostrophe apostrophe, "No, apostrophe," returned the captain. "I'll go upon my walk at once," apostrophe said Walter, "and then I shall be out of the way, Captain Cuttle. Apostrophe, take a good long nun, my lad." Apostrophe apostrophe, replied the captain, calling after him. Walter waved his hand in assent, and went his way. His way was nowhere in particular, but he thought he would go out into the fields, where he could reflect upon the unknown life before him, and resting under some tree, ponder quietly. He knew no better fields than those near Hampstead, and no better means of getting at them than by passing Mr. Dombey's house. It was as stately, and as dark as ever, when he went by and glanced up at its frowning front. The blinds were all pulled down, but the upper windows stood wide open, and the pleasant air stirring those curtains, and waving them to and fro was the only sign of animation in the whole exterior. Walter walked softly as he passed, and was glad when he had left the house a door or two behind. He looked back then, with the interest he had always felt for the place since the adventure of the lost child, years ago, and looked especially at those upper windows. While he was thus engaged, a chariot drove to the door, and a portly gentleman in black, with a heavy watch chain, alighted, and went in. When he afterwards remembered this gentleman and his equipage together, Walter had no doubt he was a physician, and then he wondered who was ill, but the discovery did not occur to him until he had walked some distance, thinking listlessly of other things. Though still, of what the house had suggested to him, for Walter pleased himself with thinking that perhaps the time might come when the beautiful child who was his old friend, and had always been so grateful to him, and so glad to see him since, might interest her brother in his behalf, and influence his fortunes for the better. He liked to imagine this more, at that moment, for the pleasure of imagining her continued remembrance of him, than for any worldly profit he might gain. But another and more sober fancy whispered to him that, if he were alive then, he would be beyond the sea and forgotten, she married, rich, proud, happy. There was no more reason why she should remember him with any interest in such an altered state of things than any plaything she ever had. No, not so much. Yet Walter so idealized the pretty child whom he had found wandering in the rough streets, and so identified her with her innocent gratitude of that night, and the simplicity and truth of its expression, that he blushed for himself as a libeller when he argued that she could ever grow proud. On the other hand, his meditations were of that fantastic order, that it seemed hardly less libelous in him to imagine her grown a woman. To think of her as anything but the same artless, gentle, winning little creature that she had been in the days of good Mrs. Brown. In a word, Walter found out that to reason with himself about Florence at all was to become very unreasonable indeed, and that he could do no better than preserve her image in his mind as something precious, unattainable, unchangeable, and indefinite in all but its power of giving him pleasure, and restraining him like an angel's hand from anything unworthy. It was a long stroll in the fields that Walter took that day, listening to the birds, and the Sunday bells, and the softened murmur of the town breathing sweet scents, glancing sometimes at the dim horizon beyond which his voyage and his place of destination lay, then looking round on the green English grass and the home landscape. But he hardly once thought even of going away, distinctly, and seemed to put off reflection idly, from hour to hour, and from minute to minute, while he yet went on reflecting all the time. Walter had left the fields behind him, and was plodding homeward in the same abstracted mood, when he heard a shout from a man, and then a woman's voice calling to him loudly by name. Turning quickly in his surprise, he saw that a hackney coach, going in the contrary direction, had stopped at no great distance, that the coachman was looking back from his box, and making signals to him with his whip, and that a young woman inside was leaning out of the window, and beckoning with immense energy. Running up to this coach, he found that the young woman was Miss Nipper, and that Miss Nipper was in such a flutter as to be almost beside herself. "Stack's Gardens, Mr. Walter." ... said Miss Nipper. "If you please, oh do." ... "Eh?" ... cried Walter. "What is the matter?" ... "Oh, Mr. Walter, Stack's Gardens, if you please." ... said Susan. "There." ... cried the coachman, appealing to Walter, with a sort of exulting despair. "That's the way the young lady's been a goin' on for a parts of a mortal hour, and me continually backing out of no thoroughfares, where she would drive up. I've had a many fares in this coach, first and last, but never such a fare as her." ... "Do you want to go to Stack's Gardens, Susan?" ... inquired Walter. "Ah, she wants to go there. Where is it?" ... growled the coachman. "I don't know where it is." ... exclaimed Susan, wildly. "Mr. Walter, I was there once myself, along with Miss Floy and our poor darling Master Paul, on the very day when you found Miss Floy in the city, for we lost her coming home, Mrs. Richards and me, and a mad bull, and Mrs. Richards' eldest, and though I went there afterwards, I can't remember where it is. I think it's sunk into the ground. Oh, Mr. Walter, don't desert me, Stack's Gardens, if you please. Miss Floy's darling, all our darlings, little meek Master Paul. Oh, Mr. Walter." ... "Good God." ... cried Walter. "Is he very ill?" ... "The pretty flower." ... cried Susan, wringing her hands, "has took the fancy that he'd like to see his old nurse, and I've come to bring her to his bedside, Mrs. Stacks, of Polly Toodle's Gardens, someone pray." ... greatly moved by what he heard, and catching Susan's earnestness immediately, Walter, now that he understood the nature of her errand, dashed into it with such ardor that the coachman had enough to do to follow closely as he ran before, inquiring here and there and everywhere the way to Stack's Gardens. There was no such place as Stack's Gardens. It had vanished from the earth. Where the old rotten summer houses once had stood, palaces now reared their heads, and granite columns of gigantic girth opened a vista to the railway world beyond. the miserable waste ground, where the refuse matter had been heaped of yore, was swallowed up and gone, and in its frozy stead were tiers of warehouses, crammed with rich goods and costly merchandise. The old by streets now swarmed with passengers and vehicles of every kind. The new streets, that had stopped disheartened in the mud and wagon ruts, formed towns within themselves, originating wholesome comforts and conveniences belonging to themselves, and never tried nor thought of until they sprung into existence. Bridges that had led to nothing, led to villas, gardens, churches, healthy public walks. The carcasses of houses, and beginnings of new thoroughfares, had started off upon the line at steam's own speed, and shot away into the country in a monster train. Apostrophe as to the neighborhood which had hesitated to acknowledge the railroad in its straggling days, that had grown wise and penitent, as any Christian might in such a case, and now boasted of its powerful and prosperous relation. There were railway patterns in its drapers' shops, and railway journals in the windows of its newsmen. There were railway hotels, office houses, lodging houses, boarding houses, railway plans, maps, views, wrappers, bottles, sandwich boxes, and timetables, railway hackney coach and stands, railway omnibuses, railway streets and buildings, railway hangers-on and parasites, and flatterers out of all calculation. There was even railway time observed in clocks, as if the sun itself had given in. Among the vanquished was the master chimney sweeper, Willem Incredulous at Stack's Gardens, who now lived in a stuccoed house 3 stories high, and gave himself out, with golden flourishes upon a varnished board, as contractor for the cleansing of railway chimneys by machinery. To and from the heart of this great change, all day and night, throbbing currents rushed and returned incessantly like its life's blood. Crowds of people and mountains of goods, departing, and arriving scores upon scores of times in every 4 and 20 hours, produced a fermentation in the place that was always in action. The very houses seemed disposed to pack up and take trips. Wonderful members of Parliament, who, little more than 20 years before, had made themselves merry with the wild railroad theories of engineers, and given them the liveliest rubs in cross-examination, went down into the north with their watches in their hands, and sent on messages before by the electric telegraph, to say that they were coming. Night and day the conquering engines rumbled at their distant work, or, advancing smoothly to their journey's end, and gliding like tame dragons into the allotted corners grooved out to the inch for their reception, stood bubbling and trembling there, making the walls quake, as if they were dilating with the secret knowledge of great powers yet unsuspected in them, and strong purposes not yet achieved. But Stack's Gardens had been cut up root and branch. Oh woe the day, when not a root of English ground laid out in Stack's Gardens is secure. At last, after much fruitless inquiry, Walter, followed by the coach and Susan, found a man who had once resided in that vanished land, and who was no other than the master sweep before referred to, grown stout, and knocking a double knock at his own door. He knowed Tootle, he said, well, belonged to the railroad, didn't he? Yes, sir, yes. Apostrophe, apostrophe, cried Susan Nipper from the coach window. Where did he live now? Hastily inquired Walter. He lived in the company's own buildings, second turning to the right, down the yard, cross over, and take the second on the right. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.